we live in an alienated world, and you can live in a dormitory crowded with people and be a totally lonely person, as some of you know. You can be in a city of several million people and be a totally lonely person, as we also know. We run into people all the time. We have contact with hundreds of people every day, but so we can be alone. Why is that? Well, one reason is that we don't treat people as people very often. We treat people as objects or as projects. But very seldom do we really treat people as people. The average day, you get up, I don't know what your average day is like. Let's take mine. Get up in the morning and put on a clean shirt, go out, have breakfast. Breakfast is there, and I eat it. Get in my car, stop for gasoline, and someone pumps gasoline into my tank. And then I get to work, and I start pushing paper back and forth and passing it here and there and talking to people about this and that. And I go home, and that's kind of it. Well, contact with people all day long, but probably I've treated most everybody that I came in contact with as an object and not as a person. See, my wife can be an egg cooker or a shirt ironer. I stop it for gas, and the person that gives me my gasoline, if we could mechanize him and have a machine instead of a person, it would be more efficient, as a matter of fact. We wouldn't need him there. And as when I get to the office and began to communicate with people, it's mainly for the purpose of passing information. And so the person is just a vehicle for passing information. And even though I have contact with them, they are basically an object. We treat people like objects all the time. Now, sometimes that's necessary. You can't stop and relate to everybody you meet. You can't stop and relate to the guy that's pumping gas. He'll say, "You know, go on, get out of here. There's a line behind you." You can't stop and fellowship every time you give a piece of paper to somebody, you know, ask, "How are you? How's your mother? How are you feeling?" and stuff. You know, you've got to treat some people as objects, but the problem is that we treat the wrong people as objects at the wrong time. It could be, you know, that my wife never is anything more than an egg cooker and a shirt presser and one who just keeps things moving in the household. And the husband can be nothing more than a money dispenser and a child spanker and a garbage disposer. And that happens all the time. You have people living on the same roof, but they treat each other as objects. Well, when it really gets bad is when it gets into the ministry. And there we begin to treat people as objects. Now, in business, the symbol of success is money. And you measure how well you're doing by how heavy the bag is that you carry to the bank. And so you evaluate yourself on that basis. Well, in the Christian ministry, what is our criteria of success? People. How many we've got. And so if we really want to be successful, we've got to have a lot. And so we say, now we want everybody out tonight, and maybe that guy sitting back there desperately needs to spend an evening with his wife. Maybe their marriage is falling apart. But for the sake of this, whatever it is, he doesn't do what he really should be doing before God and goes along with the Christian program. And to me, that's diabolical. It's more moral to use money as your symbol of success than it is to use people. And I run into this in the Navs. I'm corresponding with a girl right now who feels that God would have her, can't give you too many details. You might find out what I'm talking about. Who feels that God would have her do some particular thing. But her leader feels that it's very important for her to be at a summer training program. Now, I wonder about that. Important to whom? For what? That summer training program. Because how many people you have at a summer training program is a part of your status symbol. So we have to look successful among our peers because they count how many we've got. And we are manipulators of people. You know, I used to treat people as objects when I'd witness. I wasn't really particularly concerned about what happened in people's hearts. The thing I was really concerned about was that I be a witness. And so I would talk to somebody. And then I would come home and say, you know, real cool like to the guys at the home, I witnessed today. And the guys would say, oh, gee, yeah? How'd you do it? Nothing. Just, and then I'd tell them, blow by blow, word by word, what I did. And I had my reward right then and there. Or once in a while I would luck out. And I'd get a decision out of somebody. And so I'd come home real super cool like and say, let it go to Christ today. And then I was king for the day. And it didn't matter that the guy didn't understand diddly-do about what I said, or that he died the next morning. I led a guy to Christ. And I was successful. So, we who are involved in a personal ministry can be guilty of treating people not as people, but as objects. If our real intent is anything other than that very best person's, that person's very best interests, if we have anything but that person's very best interests at heart, we are in danger of treating him as something other than what he really is. Or we can treat people as projects. I mentioned last night about the fact that we, in the USA, we have the feeling that the key to getting the job done is efficiency. And we feel that if we just get everything down pat, everything well lined out, well defined, and then really grease the whole thing real well, that with enough effort, we're going to get it done. Well, that's just not true. That's an illusion. You know that for 5 of the 10 years that we were in Brazil, we didn't even have a telephone. And it took 15 days to send a letter to the next state and get an answer. And so communications were just plain tough. You had a message you want to give to somebody. Instead of getting on the telephone and talking to them, you'd get in your car and drive across town. It'd take you 45 minutes to communicate something that would normally take you 3 minutes. Well, think of the waste of time. Spend 15 times as much time just getting a little message across as you do here. And mail. You know, just no way. We just wouldn't even bother. Well, it dawned on me after looking back over the 10 years that we spent there that had we had all of the conveniences and all of the systems that we think are so important to accomplishing our methods and our objectives, we probably, we undoubtedly would not have been any more successful than we were. See, efficiency can work against the accomplishment of your objectives. Because when we went over to give that 3-minute message to the guy, man, you drove halfway, you know, all the way across town and halfway across town, you're going to spend 20 minutes instead of 3. And you're going to find out how he's doing. It's going to be a person-to-person contact. And so, instead of just, you know, whizzing along, getting all the information disseminated and making sure everybody's got the word and all that, we were always relating to people all the time. And that was the key to the success. But I had to get into an inconvenient situation to learn that. I'll never forget our first navigator home. It was 1958. Ed Rice was in charge. Ed Rice and Bob Glockner were in charge of the Minneapolis area. They sent Ed Rice to Africa to take over the correspondence courses that we were doing for the Mau Mau terrorist detainees. And so Bob was left with the work in Minneapolis, and then he got married. And he had six guys living with him before he got married. And I'd been married for 4.5 years, and we were just kind of coming around the NAS at the time. So he says, well, would you take the six guys? And I says, okay. So we moved out of our little bungalow and found a three-story monstrosity down in the center of town. Does this remind you of anybody you know? Oh, yeah, Bob, you read me loud and clear, don't you? Well, I'd never laid eyes on these six guys in my life when they moved in. They were just total strangers to me, and I'd never been around the navigators, as a matter of fact, before that. And I didn't know what a navigator home leader did, but I'd picked up a little bit of scuttlebutt here and there, and kind of looked around to see what other guys were doing, and kind of scoped it out. And so my wife and I moved into this monstrous house, and you know, stacked the thing from top to bottom with guys. And Bob Glockner moved in with his bride. We ran the ministry that way. Well, we did everything right. You know, breakfast is at 6:15 in the morning. And everybody, I swear it was. And everybody came down to breakfast at 6:15 with good attitudes. And everybody had his area to keep clean. You know, one guy had the living room, dining room, another guy had the lawn, another guy had the Johns, another guy had the kitchen, and so on like that. We rotated. Then we had home night, one night a week, where we'd spend at least 2 hours discussing a chapter that all the guys had prepared during the week. And then we'd pray, and then we'd discuss, you know, the things that you discuss in navigator homes together. There was lots of exhortation. You know, if a guy went by a burned out light bulb, he'd hear about it. And we evangelized the dormitory, and we hung our towels folded our towels three ways when we... And so we did the whole nine yards, you know. And I met man-to-man with all the guys. I had a desk up on the third floor, and the guys would come up there, and I'd sit down, and I'd check them out on their verses, and we'd go over how they're doing the Bible study and what's going on in the ministry, and I'd teach him some little basic principle or something. And so I'd spend an hour with him, and he'd, you know, go on out, and I'd holler, next. The next guy'd come in. You know, same deal. Well, I'll tell you, those guys are strangers when they came into that house. And they were strangers when they left. It was strangers in and strangers out. And I sensed that there was something that wasn't quite right. But I didn't really know what it was. Until just as one of the guys was leaving, you know what he said? He says, you don't love us. And he was right. You know why I didn't love them? Because I was trying my best to be a navigator home leader. And so I was busy projecting the image of a navigator home leader. And so I'd go around the house like this, you know. Nobody ever saw Peterson, really. They saw this navigator home leader. And, of course, they had no choice but to play the same game. And so they were navigator home dwellers. And so he had a year-long masquerade with this navigator home leader coming in contact with these navigator home dwellers. You know what a navigator home dweller image is? You know, one with a perpetual smile and, you know, perpetually polite, you know, always doing everything just so. And there we were, playing our silly game of charades. You know, as long as you're concerned about yourself, and as long as you're concerned about how you look and how you come across, you are not going to be able to relate to people. Because the essence of love is selflessness. And you're not going to be able to relate to people until you can take that personage, that mask off, and let people see you as you really are. And Paul did this. 1 Thessalonians 1:5. I understand you've been studying the book of Thessalonians. For our gospel did not come to you in word only, but also in power and in the Holy Spirit and with full conviction, just as you know what kind of men we proved to be among you for your sake. In other words, we didn't just give you the hot word, but you saw what kind of people we were. And then in chapter 2, he says, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel, but also our own lives, because you were very dear to us. And so he said, we exposed ourselves to you so that you could see what we were really like. And therefore, you met a real person and not just a mask. Well, how do we achieve this? We're going to build our study this morning on a passage of Scripture in Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22. This is one of these astonishing passages, because in just a few simple brushstrokes, it paints the whole message of the Christian life. God's ability to condense things and put them into concise terms, you know, they're just, you think it's inspired or something. And here, a teacher comes to Jesus, a lawyer, and he asks him a question in verse 36. What's the great commandment? And he said to them, verse 37, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Verse 39, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then he says, on this, these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. In other words, that summarizes everything. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. So you have three loves here. One, love God. Which one comes next? Huh? There's discord in the ranks. Love yourself. And then love your neighbor. Love your neighbor as yourself. Isn't that heresy? Loving yourself. Man. Well, that's what it says, isn't it? Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Love yourself first so that you can love your neighbor. And they have to be in this sweet sequence if anything's going to come out at the bottom. So the first thing that has to happen, if we are going to relate to people at all, is to love God. Now what does that have to do with it? 1 John 1:7. Take a look at it. I think this is one of these interesting verses that surprises us in what it says. Because he says, if we walk in the light, as he himself is in the light, we have fellowship, and you'd think it would say, we have fellowship with him. We walk in the light, as he is in light, then we have fellowship with God. But that's not what it says. It says, if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. Now, what does my walking in the light have to do with my ability to relate to Chris? According to this, my ability to relate to someone else, to have fellowship with someone else, have all things in common with another person, which fellowship means, depends upon my having all things in common with God, my walking with God. Now, how does that work? What happens when I walk in the light? When I come into the presence of God. Well, we have a few accounts of that in the Bible. Probably the most graphic and the one that serves us best at this point is in Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah met God. In Isaiah chapter 6, the first five verses, I'll just read it to you. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord standing on a throne, or sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Now, this is Isaiah, and he's describing what he saw. He says, I saw the Lord, lofty and exalted. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke. So Isaiah saw the Lord. What was his reaction? Then I said, ah. Woe is me. Look at how dirty I am. That's always what happens when we see the Lord. If you think you're doing pretty well, and if you think that, you know, you're getting to be a pretty good Christian, that's because you haven't seen the Lord lately. I think the more you grow, the more you get to know God, the more you realize how totally corrupt and sinful you really are. Isaiah, at this point in time, was probably not a very proud man after seeing the Lord. He says, woe is me, I am ruined. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. That's always what happens when we see God, is that we realize that we are ruined, and that any relationship with God at all, any relationship that we have, has got to be a relationship of sheer grace and mercy, because we don't deserve a thing. Well, that realization does affect the way I relate to people. And it does affect the way I relate even to myself. I think that there are times, and of course we're talking about spending time with God here. You know, you can't love God if you never spend time with him. And I know that there are times in my life that are crises. And these, and there are times which decide, they're decisive. And what happens at that point in time in my life determines what I become in the future. And there are times when I'm in the Scriptures and I see myself as I am because I see something of God as He is. And the temptation is to want to run. Because like it says in John 3, the wicked, when they come to the light, they don't want to come to the light, lest their deeds be reproved, and so they stay in the darkness. And there's a tremendous urge to stay in the darkness because you don't like to see yourself as you really are. But as I come into the light and I see myself as I really am, new insights are gained into myself and into God. And as decisions are made at those times, my life is changed. And I discover that God accepts me as I am. Therefore, I can accept myself. God has forgiven me. Therefore, I can accept myself as being a forgiven person, and I can forgive myself. And God puts a value on me. The fact that I don't understand that, but the fact that He redeemed me shows that He sees me as something of infinite value. And so it's in the presence of God that I get an accurate look at myself. And so let's go on to the second one, loving yourself. You know, there's a lot of talk about self-image. Maxwell Maltz wrote a book, Psycho-Cybernetics, and really that's what he's talking about. I'd suggest you read that book sometime. Because the thesis of the book is that most people have an inadequate self-image. And what your self-image is, it determines what you achieve, what you accomplish. And most people are underachievers because they don't really have an honest look at themselves. Good point. Well, the thing is, when I stand in the presence of God, I see that I'm a forgiven sinner, I see that I'm accepted, and therefore I can relate to myself. And I've learned something else over the years, and that is that maturity, emotional maturity, depends on two things. Your knowledge of God and your knowledge of yourself. Now let me explain that a little bit. I'll tell you a story, and I probably shouldn't tell it to you. But something happened to me a number of years ago. I'd just gotten down to Brazil, been there about a year. And George Sanchez came through and spent some time with us. And he watched my comings and goings. And then near the end, he says, "You know, Jim," he says, "I have some observations to make about you." And I says, "Well, fine." So he says, "Come here, sit down." So sat down at the dining room table. And my wife was there. And Ken Lotus was there, and his wife was there. And then George began to make these observations about me. And he pointed out that I'm a choleric. Now, a choleric is a person who has his objectives defined and will use and abuse everything in his path to get there. And then he showed me how I was using and abusing and mainly abusing all of the people around me in my efforts to get to where I wanted to go. And it seemed like he talked to me for 5 hours. It was only about 30 minutes. But he just dismounted me and left me in a pile sitting there on that chair. And, see, I was like a great big shade tree under which nothing could grow. I just sort of domineered everything around me. And George pointed that out. And I realized that the people, the closest to me, the people that I most loved, were paying an awful price just to be around me because I was not allowing them to develop. Because they had to acquiesce to that thing that I was pursuing. Well, George just left me gasping for breath. And I think for the next, 48 hours, I was indignant that he would really think those things about me. But I made a decision a few years before that saved the day at that time. And that was that when someone talks to me about something, points out a weakness, I will not defend myself or say anything for the first 24 hours. Because I know that the immediate response is to defend yourself and justify yourself. And anything that I would say, even to clarify the issue, would be kind of a backdoor attempt to justify myself. So I just kept quiet and listened and laid there gasping while he took me apart. Well, it took about 3 months just to breathe even again. I just totaled. And I thought, that I was a wipeout as far as the kingdom of God is concerned and as far as, being a husband and being able to relate to people and everything. I just figured, well, I'm just a wipeout. But your strengths and your weaknesses are related. Did you ever know that? You tell me what your weaknesses are, and I can probably tell you what your strengths are. You tell me what your strengths are, and I can probably tell you what your weaknesses are. Because they're related. And as I sat there for those months looking at my weaknesses, it began to dawn on me that they had their positive side. And I realized also what motivated me to be the way I was before. And that was that I had no inkling of who I was. Here I was, a 30-year-old man, and I didn't even know who I was. Now, chances are, very few of you here have any inkling as to who you are. And once you begin to discover who you are, you will begin to fulfill your God-given calling. Now, it's hard to discover who you are. And it takes friends like George many times to help us discover who we are. But I realized that I have an innate ability to lead. But not having clue one that was the case, I was always overdoing it. Where an effort of one would have gotten it done, I was putting an effort of 10. And I was just overkill all the time. It was like one time my two older kids and I were camping up in the forest in Brazil. And we'd been there for a week. And the last day, 32 Boy Scouts and a scoutmaster in short pants showed up and started putting up their tents. And they divided those 32 boys up into little groups of four. And each one took off to their corner and had a tent to put up and had their gear to get arranged and had a fire to build and so on. Well, a group that camped right next to us had a little, one of the four was a leader. And he was the one to organize everything, get everything done. Well, the leader of this group was incredibly insecure. And so he was just screaming all afternoon at these other three guys. Get that tent up, not that rope, get this one, go do this, go do that. And the more he screamed, the more confused and belligerent the others got. And so the less progress they made. Everybody else's tent was up, and this tent was on the ground yet. And finally, they never did get that tent up. The scoutmaster had to come along and put it up. Well, the problem was this little leader was so insecure that all he could do was scream. And a person who does not know what his equipment is, who he is, that is what he tends to do. Out of his insecurity, he just overdoes it. So I realized that God had given me certain gifts, and I could just relax. And it would happen anyway. It was like discovering that you had a whole box of tools that you'd been carrying all your life, and you never used them. And so, coming to know yourself and to accept yourself with your weaknesses and your strength makes progress. It leads you toward being able to relate to the people around you. And once you see that you do not have to be perfect, the paragon of a nav home leader, to be able to really minister to people, then you're on your way. So let's move on to the next one. Loving our neighbor. I think the key verse in my mind and in my whole life in this area is Ephesians 4:32. Be kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. And that last phrase, I think, says it all. You know, treat others the way God treats you. God has forgiven you. And you know, we usually reverse this. The average person explains himself away and justifies himself. He says, well, yeah, my father was fat. I come from a long line of fat men. Therefore, I'm fat. Or, I have a temper. It was because my mother and father had tempers. And it's inherited. Or, he'll say, well, you know, my home life was really bad, and I just never really did learn to discipline myself because we just didn't do it that way. And so we justify our weaknesses and explain them, and therefore, since we understand ourselves so well, we coexist with our weaknesses and let them stay in our lives. While at the same time, normally what we do is we treat the people around us with justice. And we say, look at him. Why doesn't he quit eating? And we're not interested in the whys, the explanations. We just see that he eats too much. And so we judge the people around us. And we explain the people to others why we are as weak as we really are. And so we're judgmental in our relationships. Now, Jesus said in Matthew 7, he said, do not judge. He didn't say, do not judge unjustly. He just said, do not judge. Period. And what should happen when we meet Christ, we are converted, aren't we? There should be a conversion. And we see that we are responsible for what we are, that just because something happened in my past does not mean that I have to continue to drag that along all my life, that I can change, that I am a responsible person. Now that goes against the philosophy of the day, but that is true, that we are responsible people, and we can choose to become something that we are not. But as the conversion takes place, we recognize that we are responsible, but then we try to understand the next guy. Why is he the way he is? Why isn't he disciplined? Well, he's never had an opportunity to learn discipline. Why doesn't he use his time wisely? Well, because, and then we try to understand why the other person is the way he is. And once we make that conversion, and treat people as God treats us, with mercy and not justice, we begin to make progress. If God treated me with justice, I would not be here right now. It is only because God treats me with mercy and grace that I can be here with you. And should I treat the people around me with anything less? You see, it's the judgments that we hold against people which destroys our ability to relate to them. Let me just illustrate it. A guy meets a gal, and man, he's never encountered anything quite like that in his life, and he just sort of numb, and he begins to spend time with her, and he can, you know, go over to her house at 8 o'clock, and man, just look at his watch, and it's midnight already. And he leaves. Next night, he's back there again, 7:30. And then midnight's there again. And night after night, day after day, man, I remember my wife was living in a girls' club, and the doors were locked at 2 o'clock in the morning on weeknights and 3 a.m. on weekends. And we just barely made it every night.
Well, what do they do with all that time? How do they spend all those hours together? Well, talk. Well, how do you find so much to talk about? What in the world can you talk about hour after hour after hour? You know what they talk about? He tells her about his aspirations, about his qualities, things that he'd never dream of telling anybody else because they'd think he's proud. But somehow or other, she just seems to think that, man, that's right. It's normal. And he feels accepted with her. And he'll tell her about things he's afraid of. He'll tell her about some dumb little thing he did when he was a kid, and he'll take an hour to tell it. And she'll tell about her childhood. She'll tell him about things that she liked to do. She describes in detail what colors she likes the best and why. Just on and on and on. And they tell each other things that they wouldn't dream of telling anybody else because they just think it's dumb. But somehow or other, it just doesn't seem dumb when they're together. And so the guy walks away and thinks, man, we really understand each other. In fact, we get along so good, and we're just meant for each other. We must get married. This must be the most unique relationship in all history. And so they get married. Well, one day, after they're married, it doesn't really happen like this, it's more progressive, but one day after they're married, he notices that, man, she talks a lot. But, you know, she's so great that he'll let that little thing go by. But he files that in his mind that, man, I just wish she wouldn't talk so much. And then the days go on and he reconfirms it there she is talking again. It begins to bug him a little bit. You know, she doesn't have to talk like that. And then she notices that, look there, he took off his pants and left them on the floor. Man, he's messy. Why'd he hang them up? But, you know, he's so cool in so many other ways that, I'm not going to say, I don't mind picking them up. Picks them up, hangs them up. But then she notices that, boy, in a lot of ways, she's kind of sloppy. And she files that and it begins to bother her. And what's happened? Judgments have been born. The first offspring of the marriage. Judgments. You know, when we first got married, you know the first thing that bugged me about my wife? She let the toothpaste drop. Now that would bother any man, don't you think? I mean, after all, I'd be in the bedroom, and I'd hear this clunk, and I knew it, and I'd say, honey, is that the toothpaste? And she'd say, yes. I wouldn't say anything, I just let it soak in. Next morning, clunk. She was so psyched out that she couldn't hold a tube of toothpaste anymore. And I'd say, honey, why can't you hang on to the toothpaste for crying out loud? Isn't that terrible? Oh. And so these judgments grow. Serious things. Like toothpaste falling and things. So one day, for some, you know, she's tired and he's off his feed or something and there's a sharp word and then it all comes out. You know, you talk too much, you know, if you just be quiet a little bit, things would be better on you. Well, you're so sloppy, you know, and so it all comes out. Everything that they've been judging all this time. And it was just as he suspected because he'd been building judgments in his heart. And he thought, man, she must be faking it too. See, because you're both faking it. And so the judgments come out. But the marriage is young and they're two love each other and so they kiss and make up and it's all over in an instant. but nothing's been resolved. Because a couple of weeks later, boom, same thing. And if they'd recorded the first argument, they could have saved their breath and said, now it's fight time again, let's put the record on it. Because the same words come out, and you make the same observations, the same accusations, and it ends up the same way, which proves that nothing was resolved the first time. You see? Everybody that you have a relationship with, the depth of that relationship is contingent on your ability to live free of judgments of that person. And if you're trying to minister to somebody, and down in your heart, you have judged him for this, this, and that, things that you just don't like about him, I'm telling you, forget it. You have disqualified yourself to minister to that person. You are out of the running. Do not judge. Now, this gets especially serious when it comes to the non-Christians or the new Christians that we're trying to reach. I think the key passage to the whole subject of reaching people is in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And let's take a look at that. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. For though I am free, verse 19. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all that I might win the more. To the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law. Though not being myself under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law. Though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ. That I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I may by all means save some. And I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may become a fellow partaker of it. Now I ask you a question. According to this passage, who adjusts to whom? Now, when you minister to people, you have to make a decision. Which of the two of us is going to be comfortable? Especially when you're ministering to people who are not in the kingdom, not Christians. Which of the two of us is going to be comfortable? Well, according to this passage, the evangelist is the one who remains uncomfortable. He adjusts to the lifestyle, the mentality of the person that he is trying to reach. But very, very seldom do we who think we're in the ministry make that kind of concessions. And that is one reason why our communication with the pagan world is so terrible. And it is terrible. Because a non-Christian comes around us and he feels like he's fallen into the hands of a reformer. We don't like the way he smells. We don't like what he puts in his mouth. We don't like what he drinks. We don't like what he puts up his arm. We don't like the way he spends his time. We don't like... And there are all kinds of things that we don't like. And when he comes around us, he feels that he's fallen into the hands of a reformer that wants to make him over into his own image. And very, very few people will respond to that. And that is why we reach so very few truly pagan people. You see, there's really only one issue. All of the things that a man does, all of his immorality, all of his sin, all of these things are only symptoms of his basic alienation from God and from himself. And no wise doctor treats symptoms. And so there's no point in attacking symptoms. Let him live in his sin. It doesn't really matter. Accept him as he is. We have this incredible passage in John 8. A woman taken in adultery. Caught in the very act. And the nice men of the city came and says, Jesus, we caught this woman. Don't you think we ought to stone her, according to the law of Moses? And Jesus said, whoever is without sin, cast the first stone. And then he broke the eye contact so that they could sit there and think about themselves and sat there and wrote on the ground a little while and got up and everybody's gone. And he says, where are your accusers? And she says, well, they're all gone. He says, this incredible thing. He says, neither do I condemn you. Can you imagine that? Go, sin no more. He could accept the sinner. He could make the sinner feel comfortable with him. And we have got to learn to do that. You see this in missions so often. You know, a missionary, before he goes overseas, he lives in a Christian world which is pretty comfortable. He has his church. He hears 3 points in a poem every Sunday morning, and another one on Sunday evening, and he's used to that. It's familiar. He sings his hymns. He goes to Sunday school, and he has Theodore Epp on the radio, and he can read Keith Miller when he wants to, and he has his Christian friends, Christian code of conduct, and there he is. And all of these things that he has, here he is, are kind of like props that hold him up and make him feel like a Christian. And that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. But what happens when you go overseas is that all of these things are taken away from you. And there you are, out in a country that is totally strange to you, without any of your props. You're just kind of naked in the wind. There you are. Well, Sunday rolls around, and you think, my friends back home, let's see, they're probably having the doxology now. And you think about that. And there you are, just you and your wife. And you feel kind of sinful, not even going to church that Sunday morning. And you think, well, man, I got to do something about that. So as time goes on, you begin to make a few contacts, and you get hold of some of your neighbors. And you say, well, look, we'd like to have you come over to the house and have a service. Well, they know what in the world that is, you know, but come on over. So the next Sunday rolls around, and in come some of your neighbors. Well, let's say they're, you know, Brazilians. So they come in, and lo and behold, they see this American, this kooky American that they can't quite understand. And what has he done? He has taken all of the chairs in his house, and he set them in the living room, in rows. And you think, well, that's really quaint. Look at those chairs in rows. Well, let's humor them. Let's sit down in them. And so they sit down in the rows. And the missionary really, he feels good. So the next Sunday rolls around, and he gets the people to come again. And this time he really works, and he puts together 3 points in a poem and gives them 3 points in a poem. And they sit in rows, and he says, man, I'm really making progress. And the next week, he translates, How Great Thou Art, from English into Portuguese. And he gets them together, and they sit there, and he says, now I'm going to teach you a song. A song? Huh. And the only thing they know is samba. So here comes, yeah. Oh. Que saudades, eh? Well, so, but they, here comes this strange melody with stranger words. And what's more, this kooky American stands and waves his arms while they sing this song. And they, I wonder why he does that. And after a while, they say, well, now there's enough of us. Now we can build a building. Well, we're just fine right here, but I guess... And so he goes out, and he builds, puts up a building. And lo and behold, they can't believe their eyes, but on one end of it, he puts on a point. And I wonder what that point is there for. Maybe it's a lightning rod. What do you think? But that point is there, see? And so he gets them all in there, once again in rows. Then they have get a Sunday school going, and they have a Sunday school superintendent. I had one missionary tell me, he says, now our church is just like in the States. We have a Sunday school superintendent. And finally, he's comfortable again. He's got all of his props put back together, and he feels like a Christian. And he's the only one in the whole congregation that is comfortable. And this happens time and time and time again. That's the story of our missionary effort. We have had people all over the world adjust to us. And as a result, the missionary effort is nothing more than a few beachheads scattered across the world in most cases. And that's tragic. But we do the same thing in our ministry to people. We've got a little curriculum figured out. First week a guy does this, second week a guy does that, third week a guy does that. Like it or not, ready or not, here it comes. And most people, it isn't made for them. But Paul says, when I'm with a Jew, I'm like a Jew. When I'm with someone who is under the law, even though I'm not under the law, I act like I am. To win those that are under the law. To one without law, the one who's, you know, just kind of really heathen, I act like that too. To make him feel comfortable. And so the key is the question, what can I do to make this person feel comfortable around me? To put him at ease. And once we learn that we love our neighbor as ourselves, put him at ease, then we begin to communicate the things of God to them.